So before I launch into tonight's talk about working with general anxiety and worry, I actually had a wonderful experience as I got off my bike over the bridge that showed me just how far along you can come with spiritual practice. As I got off my bike and I was chaining it to whatever thing I was chaining it to, there was a saxophonist playing in the background, and I became immediately, to my horror, aware that he was playing the riff from that George Michael's I'm Never Gonna Dance Again. And he kept on doing it. Now, the first thought that popped into my mind was, if only I could go back in time and kill the saxophonist who recorded that right before. But then I thought, no. That's the way I would think 20 years ago. And then I had the thought, well, I could go back and break his saxophone in two before his eyes. And then I thought, no, that's the way I would think 10, 15 years ago. Then I thought, if only I could go back in time and explain to the saxophone. How many lives will you ruin by playing that insidious piece of music? Think of how you could spare me the decades of misery having to coexist with that series of god-awful notes. Then I thought, well, I'll just focus on something else. But I have to say that that's quite a journey. So, hopefully by telling you that, the riff will go out of my head and into yours. Okay, so fear is something that it makes sense that all beings have, because it's part of the survival mechanism. Being or a species that has a survival mechanism that can feel fear. Basically, fear is simply the body preparing to either fight or flee or freeze so that it can survive a dangerous situation. That's what fear is. It's simply the sensations of survival in action. It's triggered by a part of the brain called the amygdala. It releases cortisol and adrenaline. And it also creates hyperventilation, contraction of the muscles, rapid heartbeat. So you want to have fear. If you weren't born with a fear system, a nervous system that would allow you to survive dangerous situations, like you're walking in the woods and you hear the sound of a bear and you didn't do anything, you were perfectly non-reactive, that wouldn't be a very good survival tool. So the human species, though, is capable of becoming such a dominant species because we can, beyond communication, we can plan, we can conceptualize our futures. We can actually plan and prepare for certain events. We can look forward and make sort of itineraries of what we're going to be doing. I was trying to get an appointment with my tattoo guy. He said, oh, I'm booked for 2.5 months. Like, even tattoo artists book long time in advance. Everybody. I was like, oh, okay, well, I can fit you in November. How's that? They're like, oh, my goodness. So we have this ability to give ourselves the illusion that we can control our lives because we're constantly scheduling our futures planning for all the things we want to accomplish, envisioning what everything will look like for us. We live in this idea that we can control. And so what has happened is while we've largely gotten rid of all the imminent threats that we face in life, there are few bears that I know of roaming around in Manhattan or Brooklyn. The imminent threats of wild animals or attacks by other clans trying to wipe us out is certainly diminished. So we have this fear mechanism, but rather than having it become largely dormant, in fact, our fear mechanisms are more active than ever. When they do fMRI scans on the amygdala, they see that rather than turning off, due to the way we live our lives, it's actually almost invariably they find hyper-triggered, more so than any other animal that they scan. Because we are constantly experiencing any kind of inconvenience or blip in our plans or even the slightest challenge in life as a threat to our plans, to our sense of control, our sense of being in the steering wheel of life. One of my teachers, Ajahn Chef, says that it's amazing that we all forget that any little tiny clot in the blood could bring an end to our life at any moment. And yet we rush through the present moments of our lives trying to get to futures that we think that will happen years and years into the future. That's a great presumption, an enormous presumption, that nothing will come about and throw any wrench into the plan. So having these full lives incredibly overscheduled with so many things we have to balance. So many people have careers, relationships, creative lives. We have exercise routines. We have families. You get the picture. And we want everything to be prioritized, everything to be important. Nothing can be lost. So when there's any even unconscious recognition of the fragility of it all, or any sense that there might be a wrench in the plans, there's this sense of great unease that arises. On top of that, we have such a constantly triggered amygdala that studies show that our fear mechanism sometimes just fires entirely on its own, without any provocation whatsoever. So I'm going to talk first a little bit about how general anxiety works, using both Buddhism and contemporary neuroscience, and then I'm going to talk about solutions to how to work with general anxiety. So according to the Buddha, and which has been verified by neuroscience, the first way we experience anxiety or worry is physically. The Buddha called it dukkha vedana. It's basically uncomfortable feelings. It could be a tightness in the stomach. It could be a tightness in the chest. It's interesting that the word worry, the root of it, is wurgen, which means to strangle in German. It's the feeling of just being strangled by life. So it's a physical sensation first. And interestingly enough, of course, when we scan via fMRI, MRI scans, we see that, first of all, the amygdala releases cortisol, which starts the entire autonomic nervous system, the hyperventilation, the clutching, the contraction of the muscles. All this happens before we're aware that we're even uncomfortable, worried, that we're in some state of anxiety. So first there's this physical, and we have what, for lack of a better term, we have a body of armor. We go into this defensive state as if we're going to be attacked. Sometimes this arises by association. We might have had a fight with someone or an uncomfortable situation, and the next time we see that person, the amygdala fires up and we're tense. We're already in physical defensiveness and worry. Or it could be that we had an argument or a distasteful interaction with somebody, and we meet somebody who just reminds us of that person in the past. Somebody who has the same haircut, wearing the same clothes, from the same place. The amygdala is not smart. It's from the oldest part of the brain, and it looks for any reason to trigger. So, again, we become worried. We become defensive. It could be simply a feeling in the body they've found. Interestingly enough, when people who have been through physical, the effects of war, but let's also talk about rape victims, who later on in life, when they'll go into the same physical position during the original trauma, the amygdala will trigger and they'll go back into a fight, flight, or freeze reaction. So anything can trigger this sort of physical state of worry. The next thing that happens, though, is that the mind becomes agitated. It stops becoming aware of what's going on. We become lost in the clouds. We go into a worry state. This is what the Buddha called sadosa citta, which means an agitated, fearful mind. And this has been clinically documented over and over and over again. Finally, we get to papancha, which is the Buddha's word for proliferation of thought. And basically the idea is, behind all the thinking, how can I get rid of what I'm feeling? I'm feeling worried. Why am I feeling worried? How can I get rid of it? Resistance. We resist the physical state. We resist the fact that the mind feels jumpy and agitated. We want it to go away. So how do we resist being the physical state? How do we resist it? We do three things. A, we try to divert our attention. We look for things to calm us. We might go to our favorite food. We might go to our favorite drug. Alcohol, sex, TV. We might go to anything that we've seen diverts our attention enough that we're unaware of the fact that we're uncomfortable. We don't know why. It's detached from any imminent threat, but we know we are in fear. The second thing we do is we feel a sense of, which I would say is akin to the freeze mechanism, is we feel a sense of shame, or there's something wrong with me. Why am I feeling this way? There must be something wrong with me. I can't believe I'm feeling this vulnerable, this uncomfortable. There's nothing going wrong in my life. Why do I feel this way? But the most common thing we do is the fight mechanism, which is we actively resist by A, we try to figure out or anticipate everything that can go wrong, and then we try to come up with an answer. This idea of anticipating the future gives us the illusion that, if I could only figure out how the future will play out, even the worst possibilities, I'll be prepared. And if I'm prepared, then certainly I won't worry now. That's the idea. It's never really thought out, but when you study the mind enough, you begin to see, okay, I have this habit of whenever I feel the sensations of worry or fear in the body, the next thing I do is I generally try to figure out what I'm frightened of, what could happen in the future, and how I can prepare for it. This anticipation, though, unfortunately, it doesn't work. Now, it's tempting to say that it doesn't work because, A, we can't figure out what's going to happen in the future, and that's true. Generally, all the energy we waste thinking about the future just is a waste because we're generally wrong. But that's not the real reason why it doesn't work. The real reason it doesn't work is because we're not frightened of any specific outcome. We're frightened of the fact that we don't know what's going to happen. So it's nothing specifically that's causing the fear. No thing, no outcome. It's the fact that we realize we are not in control. We don't know what's going to happen. That's what's causing fear. In other words, to use my favorite example, if you've ever watched horror movies, which I hope you have because they're very instructive, the most scary fucking horror movies are the ones where you don't see the monster. You just see the horror on the face of the protagonist. I think the original Blair Witch was made for something like $10,000, $20,000. You didn't see shit in that. But it was terrifying. The original Aliens was the scariest of the bunch, in my opinion, because you spent most of the movie never seeing that monster. And even though the monster was fairly unpleasant looking, it was much more scary when you didn't see it. The fact is, what we are terrified is not of any one thing. We're not, even when we have an undisclosed diagnosis and we think, wow, I must be really terrified of it being cancer. What we're really deeply the most frightened of in life is not knowing what's going to happen. Because it throws the greatest monkey wrench into our lives, which is we're not in control. We're not in control. Anything could happen. The illusion that we can plan 3 months or 5 months and feel certain that, oh, I'll still be there at my job, showing up with a smile on my face or a frown, whatever, I'll be there. That's a presumption. And deep down, there's a kind of recognition of that. So that the moment anything pops up, it doesn't have to be anything, there's this triggering. And then there's a sense, holy shit, it could all be wiped away. So, what do we do with this generalized, untethered, free-floating anxiety? This fear that's just fear, just a hyper-triggered amygdala that's really not frightened of anything in specific, just frightened of the fact that we're not really in control. Well, I like to start with my favorite, or one of my favorites of the teachings of the Buddha, which is Sakka's demon. Sakka, the king, was on a journey from his throne. And when he departed his throne, in his absence, while his guards were sleeping, inattentive, a demon, a small demon, ran past the sleeping guards and jumped on the throne and sat there. Like a cat when you're awake, going on your laptop. Just step there. It was a little demon, not very big. So at first, when the demon appeared, the guards, when they woke up and saw it, they immediately became very upset. There's a demon where Sokka should be on the throne, and they tried to get rid of the demon. They shouted insults at it, and they made threats, and they poked at it with their, I don't know what the guards had, but they poked at it with something, with a poker. And so the demon, with each taunt and each hostility and each assault, became larger and more fearsome and bigger. Pretty soon it became terrifyingly large, breathing fire. And the guards were so terrified they ran away, leaving the throne entirely and the castle entirely to the demon. So when Sokka returned, he found all of his attendants cowering outside and heard the roars from inside. And he asked what was going on, and when he heard, he said, "It's not going to be a problem." He walked inside, and rather than attack or push or take on the demon, he said, "Welcome. Hi. Welcome to my castle. Welcome to my throne. What can I do for you? How can I make you comfortable? What can I bring you? Can you put your feet up?" And with each act of attention and compassion, the demon got smaller and smaller and smaller until it shrunk even smaller than its original size. And Sokka could simply lift the demon off of the throne and put it down, and it ran off. He never had to attack it, to push it away. He never had to do any form of resistance. It was simply by acknowledging and extending courtesy to it that the demon eventually became manageable. Now, this encapsulates so much of 2,500 years of the Buddhist path to working with worry and anxiety. The first thing is to notice in the story that the guards were asleep. That's a metaphor for we're often so lost in the daydream of our lives that we don't even notice how primarily physical our worry is. We don't have our eyes on the throne. We don't realize that the seeds of worry have been planted. We're tight, we're tense, we're breathing in a contracted way. But the next thing is that often when we experience the first unease in our lives, the first sense of, "Oh my God, I'm worried about something, something's wrong, what's going on here, I don't like what's happening," the next thing we do is we do what the guards did. We try to get rid of it. "How dare I feel this way? I've got to get rid of this. This is wrong," or, "I'll figure it out, I'll get rid of it by being resistant." And what this story goes on to show is rather than by resisting the feeling of being uncomfortable, if we simply turn to it, we acknowledge it. "Hi, I see you. This is what it feels like. This is what worry feels like. To be a human being means I'm going to experience worry and anxiety." But rather than greet it with the sense that there's something wrong with me, that I'm unique or I'm specially nervous or that this is something about me, rather than by trying to get rid of it, we simply then, after we acknowledge, "Hi, I see this state in me, I see that I'm worried," then what we do is we say, "Okay, I'm going to relax around it. I'm going to see, how can I breathe comfortably? What can I do?" Like the Sokka offered the demon, "How, relax, what can I bring you? Can I bring you some food? Well, how can I make you comfortable?" We can then even go to the very sensations of worry. And rather than say, "Okay, let's figure out what's going to happen in the future. We'll prepare. Instead, we can say, right now, how can we be comfortable together? How can I be comfortable while having worry? How can I be comfortable while having anxiety? How can I be with it without resisting it? It's the resistance we find over and over and over again. The resistance to worry, to fear, that makes it stronger, that makes it dominant. When we, on the other hand, don't resist, and we relax around it at first, and we ask ourselves, what can I do for myself right now that can make me feel right now, not in the future, but right now, how can I be comfortable? How can I take care of myself right now? Sometimes this, what we might need when we really open ourselves to what can I do that will make myself comfortable with anxiety, with fear, it might not be the most productive thing in the world. Sometimes we really need to stop and take care of ourselves. And even though we want to be doing a million different productive things, it's that racing through life, trying to get ahead of the fear and the worry that's not working. And we might have to be open to the idea that we might need to take some time off to take care of ourselves. Sometimes we might have to open to the idea that we might need to call on someone for help or someone to share what we're going through. Or we might need to simply find a bench by the water and sit and relax and close our eyes. And all those schedules, all those plans, all those things that we've determined we have to do, the artwork and the job and the this and the that, they might have to, for a moment, be put aside. But that's what being with ourselves, taking care of ourselves, requires. It requires prioritizing our mental health, our spiritual health. Now, there are a few other things that we can find shelter in while we're working with anxiety and fear and worry. The first is the refuge of the present. In my experience, whenever I'm worrying, whenever there's any anxiety, I can be sure of one thing. That one thing is, there's nothing fucking happening. Because if there was something happening, I would be dealing with it. If there was a bear rampaging, if there was a, you know, a doctor with with an imminent diagnosis, or somebody that was really angry in my presence, or if there was, I had to steer a, well, I don't really drive that much, but if I did have to deal with something, I wouldn't be sitting there ruminating about, oh, what's going to happen? Right now, there's nothing fucking happening. Look around you. There's a bunch of people sitting around you. I guarantee you, the next time you're worrying or anxious, look around. Nothing will be happening at that moment. Nothing. There is unlimited peace and security if you look for it in the present when you're worrying, because the fact that you're worrying means there's nothing happening to you. It's all about something that may or may not happen that you're guessing about. But generally, if you open into what's happening in the present, you'll find that there's no threat right now. It's almost always the same, by the way, with resentments. We're almost always angry with somebody who's not there. And we're worrying about things that haven't happened. Mark Twain said that the worst things in his life never actually occurred. Great story about a monk who was telling his students that he was in a little bit of residual pain because he had to remove his own tooth with a pair of pliers after a bad succession of toothaches. And the students said, oh my God, you must have been terrified. And the monk said, well, when I realized I had to remove the tooth, there wasn't anything to be frightened of right then, at that exact moment. When I walked to the tool shed, nothing was happening. When I borrowed the pliers, nothing was happening. When I put the pliers around the tooth and yanked it out, that was really fucked up, in my own words. But then it was over, and now nothing's happening. Now, if you look at the way most of us would deal with it, be like, oh my God, I gotta remove my tooth with pliers. We never even get to the point of, you know, I mean, it's, we'd just be in agony right there. So awakening into the present. The second is, I just made a very high-pitched voice in that story, by the way. I don't know why I did that. Awakening into change, which is simply awakening into the fact that if we really reflect on what we were worrying about a year ago, I guarantee you, you're not worrying about it now. It's a good exercise. If you ever, you know, keep a journal, which I don't, but if you ever did, or if you ever just can ask a friend, what was I worrying about the last time you talked to me? It will be about something that is so resolved and has nothing to do with what you're worrying about now. It's the truth of change. No matter what, there will always be something that you'll be fucking worried about 6 months from now. You won't be worrying about what's on your plate now, or whatever is kicking up in your mind. Kaganusati is the Buddha's teaching on reflecting that there is love and compassion in our lives. It's not always from the person we want it to be. Sometimes we want it to be from the person we're in the relationship with, or the parent, or the friend, or the boss, or whatever. And we don't get it. And it's not fun. And it sucks. But we have to take the time to reflect that there is love in our lives. That there is someone who's answering the phone. Maranusati is reflecting on the fact that life is short. And in the end, will any of this shit that I'm really pinning my happiness to, will it really ever be the thing that I look back on when I think about what was important in my life? What people do reflect on is, did I love well? Did I show up for my friends? Did I allow myself to enjoy life? Generally, the things we worry about are never going to be the things that we look back on and reflect on. And finally, Silanusati is reflecting on, if we have a practice, which, by the way, people who meditate, it's shown in clinical scans of the amygdala, the amygdala stops firing as much. We become naturally calmer. But if we reflect that true happiness is available in our lives, we become less bent out of shape by whatever fears and anxieties are cropping up. So that's tonight's talk on working with anxiety and worry, general anxiety. I thank you so much for listening. I hope there was something worthwhile somewhere in there. And now what we need is one of our brave volunteers to ask a question or share or offer something for us to start talking about. Hi.
I just wanted to comment.